This is episode 7 of the Software Freedom Law Show.
Here we are for another episode of the Software Freedom Law Show. Yeah, I know I sound like I'm trying to be some sort of like radio announcer that's an archetype in my head from those annoying 80s DJs I listen to as
well. We have a cool microphone, so it sort of has this, like, I feel like we need big headphones too.
Well, I did have big headphones on a minute ago when we were recording in a different segment, so yeah, it's part of it. Yeah, you know, I have this vision in my head of the 80s DJ, you know, that I listened to when I was a teenager. Uh-huh. And my father actually used to call this stuff kiddie drivel, is I think the word he used, of this DJ stuff I used to listen to, of, you know, the local Top 40 station. And I used to listen to Top 40 music.
Well, at some point we need free software DJ names.
Yeah, I don't want a free software DJ, but when I start talking into the microphone, I have in my head that I have to sound like that. But then I get over it really quick. So, but you know, I was looking over our catalog so far, because mm-hmm. we've got a growing catalog.
We sure do.
Of episodes, and I realize we've been biased towards lawyers who are inside counsel for companies. All our lawyer interviews so far have been inside counsel.
It's true, which is great, because inside counsel has a perspective that's often hard to get. Mm-hmm. It's perspective that outside lawyers and nonprofit lawyers have a hard time finding out, and gives them a special expertise. However, today we actually have a guest who is outside counsel.
Outside counsel. So what does outside counsel mean exactly? I mean, I know we've gone over it before, but mm-hmm. some of our listeners still might be confused of this inside-outside counsel thing.
Well, inside counsel is a lawyer who's an employee of the company. Mm-hmm. So
like Scott was when we talked to him, he's a employee
exactly,
of HP.
Exactly, or Richard Fontana was, or is, with at Red Hat. Mm-hmm. And so it's a lawyer who actually is a part of the company. Outside counsel is actually a lawyer who is not an employee of the company, but provides the company with legal services. So it's often a person at a law firm or a solo practitioner. It's someone who sometimes just somebody who hangs out a shingle and says they're available mm-hmm. to give legal advice. But it's sort of a different relationship with the client, because outside counsel often has lots and lots of different clients, and so mm-hmm. they get to see often trends in the field mm-hmm. that inside lawyers might not.
So could it be analogized to, yeah, for software developers, being an employee software developer versus being a contractor coming mm-hmm. in? Mm-hmm. Is it similar to that?
Yeah, it very much could be, and it probably runs the gamut in the same way, where some lawyers have one big client and they do most of their legal work for that one client, and mm-hmm. then many others do lots of little matters for many clients. So it can be very much the same.
Okay, so I think this will be a great introduction of some views from an outside counsel who works with open source and free software. So we hope you'll enjoy our interview coming up.
Hi, we're back. And with us now, we have a guest. We have Van Lindberg, who's an associate at Haynes Boone. Hi, Van.
Hello, how are you doing?
We're good. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, we're glad you were able to join us for our show.
I'm happy to be here.
One of the things that I wanted to ask you is relating to what generally we're trying to cover in our podcast, which is different people who are involved in different areas of the law of that affects free software. So you're a little bit unusual in our guests thus far in that you're actually an associate at a law firm.
Yes.
So I guess if you could just give us a little bit of background about yourself, maybe I guess if you could start by telling us how you became involved with free software.
Well, I was involved with free software for a long time before I was ever involved with the law. I first got introduced to free software in, I think it was about 94, when I was in college, and my next door neighbor was installing a 0.99 something version of Linux, and he introduced me to it and set me up. And since then, I've just really been interested in it. It was because of that I started studying computer science, and so I could get an account on one of the Unix machines. And from there, it just blossomed.
So So what made you go to law school?
Well, I've always been interested in the law. My parents are actually both lawyers, not doing patent and copyright and similar work, but one's a judge and the other does really zoning law and real estate and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I had grown up seeing them debating legal issues, and so it was always a little bit part of my blood. And so I had thought for a long time about going to law school, and that was what I had originally wanted to do. But at the same time, I'd always been fascinated with technology, you know, programming things and playing with things. And we had a good friend who said, you should look at going into patent law. And so I looked at it and I thought, this is just what I want to do, is something that would combine both the technical aspect as well as the legal aspect of what I was interested in.
And that was actually one of the reasons why I went to law school as well, funnily enough. Or I guess not so funnily enough, since we're both in the same field. But did you find that, do you find that to be the case? That you're at the right, a nice intersection of those kinds of legal analysis and also the technical realm that you loved being a part of too?
I do think that it is about as close as you can come to bridging that gap and having a foot in both worlds. However, I find that I miss coding enough that I still write things on the side.
Well, you're somewhat involved with the Python community,
yes,
right?
Yes, I am.
Cool. What have you been doing lately in the Python world?
Right now, I'm writing an IMAP proxy server.
Oh, great.
I wanted to be able to merge several virtual accounts several real accounts into one virtual account, and there wasn't anything that did it the way I wanted, and so I thought I would write it myself.
Yeah, I use offline IMAP for that, but the difference there, of course, is it copies everything to your local hard drive, which some people find really frustrating.
Yes, offline IMAP is great. It's just that I couldn't. I'm space constrained on the server where I want to host it,
right, yeah.
And so part of the idea is that this would allow me to have a huge virtual mailbox. But I'm probably getting quite far beyond the confines of the law. But
one of the interesting things that we wanted to talk to you about is your book, because it's very well tuned to talking to people who are technically minded and involved with software about various legal issues. So can you just tell us a little bit generally about how the idea of the book came about and give us all the details on it?
Yeah. It came about as because a lot of what I find myself doing in my day-to-day practice is, I call it translating, from lawyer to engineer and back. Because there are different sets of assumptions, there's different ways of approaching problems and approaching the world, and so many times the people who are speaking they're both using English, but they're using it and thinking in such different ways as to be talking right past each other. And so one of the things that I've been doing a lot is explaining technical concepts to lawyers and legal concepts to engineers, and several people suggested, you know, why shouldn't you write this down so that more people can... so that more people know this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed to me that there was a lot of interesting writing going on around free software. But it was interesting because there was some academic writing, mostly for law professors or economics profs. You know, there was some business writing about, okay, how do you do this? There was some technical writing, but there was nothing really geared at trying to explain these legal issues to the developers, who were the ones really on the front lines of creating and using and working with free software. And they were the ones most directly affected by a lot of these legal issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the genesis of the book.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I liked a lot about it was I noticed earlier in the interview you avoided using the term intellectual property when it was easy to use, which in fact you didn't in your book. But I really like that you explained your reasoning why and the, you know, your awareness of, you know, our community's feeling about that term and the reasoning why that you were choosing to use it. So I think it was really great that you covered the topics from the point of view of understanding the way the free software world thinks about these topics and tried to approach them, you know, with your own, obviously your own views, but with an understanding of everything. Was that conscious on your part? I'm curious, or did you just get lucky that it happened to turn out that way?
Was which part conscious? Not
that you really did. You, it seems like you really researched the free software world. Was that something you actively did to get ready for the book, or were you just already so familiar with it that it just came naturally?
This is something that I've been familiar with. I've been working with or using free software, or you know, for what it's worth, reading Slashdot or whatever for almost 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was on the BBSs before that. It's the...
So it's really just that accumulated time of all this knowledge that you were able, once you knew about the legal issues, just to automatically sort of translate into the world that you had been already familiar with, I guess.
Exactly. This is... In some ways, I still think of myself as a hacker at heart.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're not the only one, I think. So given that background, what would you say? You know, because your book, one of the good things it does is it does, even though it uses, you know, that term we don't like, it goes carefully through copyrights, patents, and trademarks separately.
Mm-hmm.
Taking each of those things, you know, copyrights, patents, and trademarks, can you sort of talk about one thing that you find engineers and software developers misunderstand about each of those things? And, you know, sort of if you had a chance to tell somebody one thing about each of those topics that they really should pay attention to that they probably don't know, what would it be?
That's an interesting question. I would start out with patents, and I would say probably that a lot of the thing that most people worry about relative to patents are software patents. Now, I'm not saying that software patents aren't a problem, and I'm not saying that the patent system in general is always working as it should. But I do think that...
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Are you a patent lawyer?
I, among other things, yes.
Okay.
So you're saying about the difference between software patents and other types?
Sorry
about
that.
Well, just I think that people worry generally too much about patents. And the reason why I say this is I think that they should be worried about and dealt with on a policy level. But when it comes down right down to it, the companies that I work with, and this is both commercial as well as open source companies, they are generally focused on innovating, on solving problems, on creating new things. And I think that that is exactly where the emphasis should be. If you spend all your time worrying about software patents, then you're going to be paralyzed and you're not going to do a lot of these interesting and valuable things. I think that there have been some patents that have been granted that probably shouldn't have, but until someone really makes an issue out of that by filing something in court, no one actually knows what the patent means. So go ahead and create, because the trail that you create through your documentation, through the Subversion or CVS repositories or you know, whatever repository system that you're using,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That is, in a lot of ways, your best defense against any patent. You can show what you did and when you did it. And I think that there's more heat than there needs to be around this issue.
Yep, I think that's pretty much the same advice that we're often giving clients as well, because there's a lot of fear of that kind of paralyzing fear. We see that a lot too with developers when especially if you're not operating in a space that's well known as a landmine area, you know, things like audio codecs and so forth, which where there's a lot of well-known patents that are to be afraid of there. Generally speaking, if you're just writing, you know, sort of general purpose software for some particular task that's not necessarily one of these push button issues, it's a pretty straightforward question. You just invent and wait for somebody to actually complain, because that's up to the patent holders to do.
So
that's a good answer with patents. What about copyrights? What do you think folks should be thinking about, that one thing that they should know that they often aren't aware of?
I think that with copyrights, people are a little too lax about actually taking care of some of the nitty gritty of making sure that the necessary rights get assigned. Let me explain this by using an example. A lot of times in free software projects, you have a series of things that go along with having committer status. You need to have shown a history of having good contributions. You need to maybe give them your SSH key so that you can have secure access to the repository. You need to do certain things so that they know, all right, here's something that we can trust, that we can handle. There's a little bit of, for lack of a better term, paperwork or procedure that you go through to start committing code. I really think that because of there's such a focus on code, and because copyright is so central to how free software works legally, that projects should be more careful about making sure that the legal issues also get dealt with. There should be a committer agreement. There should be, if you work for a company, there should be a corporate release or a corporate committer agreement. There should be, if it's the type of project where everyone assigns copyright, that should be set up. And I think that just isn't done enough. And so if you have a very successful project, that can really lead to headaches down the line if you don't have those things.
Yep. In fact, it's so funny for me to hear you say that, because for many years in the free software world, you may remember the Free Software Foundation was always the butt of every joke, because they required that kind of process for their projects, and
they were pilloried
What's that?
They were pilloried for it.
And it's so funny now that people are starting to finally realize that there was a reason that was designed, because of these types of problems that get introduced. Although you didn't mention one problem that I see a lot, and I'm curious to hear what you think about it, which is, you know, even when somebody's gone through a copyright assignment and has some sort of committer agreement or so forth, a lot of times what they're committing is patches taken from the community, from a mailing list, and their copyright provenance is maybe unknown because they were posted by somebody to a mailing list or so forth, which basically ends up circumventing that whole process to some extent, because the guys and gals who do have commit status end up being basically taking contributions from people who don't have anything set up because they've just posted a patch to a mailing list.
That's a big problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the reasons why we say that projects should establish the procedures and put all that, as you say, paperwork in place early, because then it's sort of easy to fit these things into a framework.
Yeah. And I'm the only person I know that when I post a patch to a mailing list, the last line of my email is the license I'm licensing the patch under. Everybody else just posts the patch, and it's assumed it's under the license of the project you wrote the patch for. But if you don't say it explicitly, it's a little bit ambiguous. That's why I always, at the bottom of my line, this patch GPLv3 or later, copyright by me, GPLv3 or later. Just that way, if anybody pulls the email archives, they'll see.
There's never any doubt.
Yeah, I don't like leaving any doubt about what license I put something under. So there's copyrights and patents. What about trademarks? What is the one thing you think people ought to know about that, if you only have one thing to tell them?
Trademarks are not copyrights.
Good answer.
That's a great answer.
Do you want to expand on that a little bit? No? We get the joke, but I'm not completely sure our listeners will.
Well, so trademark law operates under a completely different set of assumptions than copyright law. So a lot of times you see dust-ups in the community because people are trying to obey the trademark law, and inevitably someone comes out with the suggestion, well, why don't they just license their trademark under the GPL or under the BSD license or one of these copyright licenses, not realizing that that is completely ineffective in a trademark sense and will lead to the loss of the trademark. For the readers who are not, or listeners, I should say, who are not familiar with trademarks need to be defended or else you lose them. And so simply putting the piece of art under a copyright license may allow people to use the art in one sense without violating any copyright. But if the person who's trying to maintain that trademark, say Red Hat or Mozilla or the Python Software Foundation, who I work with, then simply if they don't control the use of that trademark, then they will lose it. And it's not trying to be controlling. It's simply a fact of how the law is structured. And if that's the game, you need to play it.
Yeah, I think that goes hand in hand with another confusion, actually, that a lot of people have, which is that trademark is actually quite limited in its thrust, and that trademark really is concerned with whether or not there's any consumer confusion in the market. So whether consumers might think, for example, that one product was from another. Mm-hmm. And I think that sometimes in that same confusion that you're talking about, people often think that trademark has a much more expansive scope than it does.
That's right.
And it's sort of the flip side of what you're talking about.
Yes. And so there's this idea that information wants to be free, and so even in the free software realm, you know, we talk about free software, but that's been given a very specific definition. That's free with as defined by having certain rights attached. That doesn't mean, especially in the case of the GPL, that you can do anything that you want with it.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, when you're talking about trademarks, even when it's a trademark that is owned by or pertains to a free software project, or the Software Freedom Law Center, or something like that, you still need to obey the rules of the road.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, one of the things I point out to free software developers a lot is that, you know, your trademarks are actually sort of the most, in some ways, very important part of the law that free software developers can use. Because in the end, in the free software world, what matters is your name. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of people, that's their individual name, you know, what they're well known for, what co-contributions they've made. But also your project's name is important, and knowing who you are out in the world is important. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what trademark's designed to do. And as Karen points out, very limited in its scope. So it's not very burdensome, you know, when you want to work around a trademark. For example, the great thing I like to say is that a GNU is almost the perfect name to avoid violating the trademark of Unix, because it actually expands to say this product is not Unix.
Mm-hmm.
So there's never going to be consumer confusion about, you know, is GNU really Unix? Well, no, GNU's not Unix.
Mm-hmm.
So it's actually not that hard to avoid trademark infringement, and it allows you to protect your name and make sure people know who you are.
And especially when so many people are trying to figure out how to make businesses around free software, your mm-hmm. name, your brand, is an essential part of that. Think mm-hmm. of Red Hat. Their software is all free software, but they're able to sell it because, in large part, because of their brand. Now, companies like Oracle or others have tried to take the same bits, the same code,
mm-hmm.
and sell it under their own brand, and they've had a little bit of success because some people are only interested in the brand, in the bits. But for everyone who's interested in that brand, that is one of their most valuable possessions, and they've got to keep that because that's part of what they sell.
Yep, that's certainly Bob Young's vision, original vision for Red Hat. I heard him give a speech that was the theme of his speech in 1993, was this is what my company's going to be. It's going to be a brand, and that's definitely true. So I guess one other thing, we've talked a lot about all these topics which are covered in your book, and I really want to be on record. I've told you already that I think most of your book is great. I think it's really recommended. I think there's like one chapter in it, just one, where you and I have a bit of a disagreement, which is the discussion of derivative works. And of course, we've debated this quite a bit, but this is an interview with you, so I want to give you a chance to talk about your position on that and how you cover that in your book.
Well, let me start out by sort of pointing out where we agree that a lot of times this doesn't come up. This is one of the tricky questions where it 99 times out of 100, you're not doing deep analysis. It's either apparent what the correct answer is, and pretty much everyone will agree. The problem is, as I put it in the book, I think that there is ambiguity around how far the role of derivative works reaches. Now, the reason why this matters is because the GPL and similar licenses, and particularly the code sharing provisions, are designed to go exactly as far as copyright law will take them.
Right, and that part we agree on too.
And the problem is that the law is very fuzzy when it comes to defining derivative works.
Indeed.
And it becomes even more fuzzy when you have the strange amalgam of expression and function that is software. Now, the way that I finishing my point as to why this matters, I think that uncertainty causes people to shy away from free software. They aren't sure how far it'll go, and so you see reactionary, well, I know it doesn't go this far, policies. You see strange policies about never not using GCC or not ever having free software installed on your desktop. I mean, that has nothing to do with the code. People can use free software without ever running into these sorts of issues. I think that that's a reaction against the ambiguity.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that part too, actually. I think where I differ is I think I if you had been saying this 10 years ago to me, I would have actually been like, oh my gosh, you're right. This is a really big worry. Is free software ever going to get adopted? I just think we've passed the tipping point or the watershed moment, any way you want to describe it, such that while there are new people coming in who still fear that ambiguity, there are already so many businesses that have really explored. I mean, Red Hat, you gave as an example before. I mean, for years, Red Hat was in communication with everybody in the free software world, you know, like Richard Stallman and so forth, investigating the lines of that ambiguity and building their business around where they thought the lines were. So I think that a lot of businesses have gotten there and are comfortable with it. And there's actually this neat thing going on where companies like Red Hat are out there, since we've taken them as our example here, are out there explaining their understanding of it one more level deeper to their customers, such mm-hmm. that you've got everybody sort of learning this rules of the road. And we had Richard Fontana on a couple of weeks ago, and he talked about this idea of the lex mercatori, and that there's this way of understanding of doing business that maybe is not sort of a written down type of legislative system, obviously, because we haven't had cases decide these questions. But there's really, I think, a large consensus and understanding about where the lines are for most of the situations that come up. So I'm less worried about that only because I think we've reached that moment.
See, I come at this from a slightly different perspective, where the calls that I get about free software issues are from in-house counsel who all of a sudden realize, oh my gosh, we've got free software in here. I don't know what this means. Mm-hmm. And so there, and those calls happen so frequently and with such large companies sometimes that I think while, yes, it's true that you do have early adopters that have worked through these issues and come to an understanding for themselves, I think that the majority of the business world is still afraid.
But we have people like you out there to answer their questions.
Maybe so.
So you're out there taking one for the team, and we appreciate it.
I think there's so much information that that's starting to, I mean, not starting to, but that's out there now and that continues to be published, that I think that the learning curve is a quick one for most in-house counsel, because we encounter that a lot as well and help get people a little bit more comfortable and educated with it. And once people start to begin to understand the concepts, they get significantly less afraid.
That's true. So moving on to where we disagree is a lot of it has to do with the idea of linking and trying to figure out if you link these two binary images together, does it make a derivative work? Now, the position that has generally been taken by the Free Software Foundation and the SFLC is that linking does create, linking of any sort does create a derivative work. And then the frequently asked questions, which was written by Bradley, and he's probably fair to take umbrage if he wants to, also includes a statement that tight communication through memory is approximately the same thing as linking.
Actually, RMS wrote that part, just to be clear.
Ah.
I recall distinctly he wrote that.
And the main difference that I draw out in the book is that I've got an idea about where the line is. And now these aren't things that haven't been decided by a court, and so we don't really know. And so everyone has their own opinion and their own analysis. But the way that mine goes is that you look at the reserved rights under copyright. Now, copyright law allows you to do, or more accurately, to prohibit others from doing certain things. There's copying, there's public performance, there is, among these are creating a derivative work, but the definition of derivative work is circular. And so you look at these other things and you say, all right, what about these sorts of interactions would implicate some of those reserved rights? Now let's take this example of communication through memory. If you are talking between these two programs, are you copying anything? No, they're just messages going back and forth.
Well, sometimes you are copying something. Yeah, see, the reason I apologize to interrupt you, but I think one of the problems with this topic is it's so difficult to do this analysis without a fact mm-hmm. pattern in front of you. That's always been sort of my point, is that the question is, what is the work under copyright law? And it's hard to know what the work is without looking at an actual mm-hmm. fact pattern of an actual situation.
And if you look at the cases that there are, to the extent that they are out there, they're so fact dependent that it's hard to have general rules that can be applied to general fact patterns without drilling down and coming up with examples.
Yes. You're absolutely right that analysis in the abstract isn't really all that helpful. I mean, mm-hmm. it can help guide things, but it doesn't really say what is or is not right.
Yeah, and I think one of the goals of those of us, you know, sort of on my side of the equation in the hardcore copyleft community, as it were, is just to try to be reasonable about these questions and try to do our best to not basically be abusive with the way that we look at the question and try to be, you know, in fact, copyright minimalist. As you know, we've had this little public thing going where I talk about how I'm a copyright minimalist, and I certainly am. I certainly don't want to see the scope of copyright go further. And I would be sad to see a GPL case that forced the scope of copyright further. On the other hand, you know, Disney constantly keeps pushing the scope of copyright further, and it inadvertently affects software. So there is that balance to be struck. But we do somewhat need to wrap up the interview. But I want to make sure people hear about your book, because despite my disagreement with one chapter, I recommend it, because the rest of it is just I can't recommend the rest of it highly enough. So do you want to tell everybody the publisher and the title and everything, so they know where to find it?
Yes, it is Intellectual Property and Open Source. It's published by O'Reilly, and it's available from O'Reilly's website or at Amazon or at fine bookstores nationwide.
And for that limited area that we disagree, I think we actually agree on far more of the topics, and I think that people often don't understand that. Mm. And I think what's highlighted is our areas of contention, when in fact there's a much broader field of where we all agree.
Yeah, and by percentage of this interview, I think people will find that for like 98% of the time, Van and I were agreeing, and 2% we weren't. So I think that sort of shows how much there is out there. Van, I want to thank you for writing the book. I've seen lots of blog posts from hackers. Mm-hmm. Every couple of months, I see a blog post from another hacker who's read it and said it really helped them understand the issues. It's a real contribution to the community to help spread the ideas. And of course, we want to see. I believe in free speech deeply. I want to see ideas that disagree with mine published all the time, and I certainly want people to read them. So thanks for your time, and keep up the good work of getting people to not be afraid of free software in their companies.
Thank you very much. I appreciate what you're doing as well.
Great. Thank you.
Bye then.
Bye. Bye.
So you managed not to fight with Van.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I was actually expecting a little bit more of a debate, but I think it goes to show exactly what we were saying at the end there, is that there's so much agreement about the really important issues, which is how to think about copyrights, patents, and trademarks in reference to open source and free software.
It's true. It's fascinating that that essentially people like us who are with something of an advocacy organization, a nonprofit supporting free software, can be in agreement with someone who is primarily representing, working in a law firm and representing corporate interests.
Yeah, well, that's the continuing story of open source and free software that people forget, is that the whole thing, you know, GPL, from GPL to everything that's really ever been written about it, the goal was to put commercial and non-commercial activity on equal mm-hmm. footing. So it's kind of no surprise to me that we find that. Because as Bob Young, as I was quoting him and during the interview, said, you know, that was his goal, was to make a company in Red Hat that was going to be a free software company mm-hmm. that just made money doing that stuff. And I think more companies discover that all the time. Red Hat was way ahead of the curve. But there's more and more companies realizing that it's not just about non-commercial, nonprofit activity, which is mm-hmm. sort of the side I like better. But there is this other side of for-profit, money-making.
And the spirit of collaboration, it's not just a motto, it's really the undercurrent of what we do.
Yep. Yeah, so, I agree.
And I think that comes out even in the lawyers.
Yeah, even in the lawyers. Well, as Van said, he thinks of himself as a hacker, and he certainly feels like I'm talking to a hacker more than I talk to a lawyer, like I do around here with you guys. You know, there's a certain type of lawyer that is like the hacker, and that's the ones who gravitate and find their way in this world.
And often find their way onto our show.
Indeed.
Until next time. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Bye.
Software Freedom Law Show is produced by Dan Lynch of HalfBakedMedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This show is released under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution No Derivative Works 3.0 United States license.